Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. It's the show where we tell stories from America's, and for this episode, the world's culture divides. I'm Trey Kay. Moazzam Beg is a British-born citizen of Pakistani heritage. Albert Malisi is a former housing police officer in the Boston area. Their life stories were unlikely to ever intersect. But then 9/11 happened. You'd have to be living under a rock or on another planet not to know how the terrorist attacks of 9/11 have redefined our times. It's one of those demarcations like pre-war or antebellum, before the flood or before Christ. And similar to events like Pearl Harbor or the Kennedy assassination, people tend to recall exactly what they were doing when they learned the news.
Good morning, everybody. I am Jane Hansen in the News Channel 4 studio this morning to bring you some news.
Yeah, we're looking at a
question on
the World
Trade Center.
My God.
That looks like a second plane.
I know where I was on the morning of 9/11. I was standing with neighbors on the roof of our Brooklyn apartment building. I remember the Twin Towers crashing down. I remember watching the debris cloud push out from between the buildings at the lower end of Manhattan. It kind of was like a kid squeezing Play-Doh out of an extruder. I watched the cloud roll across the New York Harbor towards our neighborhood. Soon it hovered over us and covered everything like snow.
Hello.
Albert Malisi and Moazzam Beg are crystal clear about where they were as well.
I actually got off a double shift and I slept through the whole thing. And when I turned on the TV, I thought Die Hard, the movie Die Hard, was on TV, tell you the truth. And then I realized this was real news and things were happening.
So on 9/11, 2001, I was in Afghanistan in the city of Kabul, which is where I was living with my wife and kids, working on a project that we'd begun from the UK to build a school.
Not even 24 hours later, my National Guard unit was at alert. I had to notify my job that I was at alert and I could be pulled at any time.
I have to admit, I didn't even know what the Twin Towers were before 9/11.
Moazzam Beg was born and raised in Birmingham, England, which wasn't always an easy place for a second-generation Pakistani to grow up.
There was an Us and Them at that time. The Us was whoever I happened to be connected to, which was mostly predominantly Asian people, but not exclusively. And the Them would have been aspects of the far right, who were not, as they are, necessarily anti-Muslim. That didn't matter at that time. It was more just anti-immigration, more xenophobic than directly towards any particular group of people.
And I understand that during this time of your life, you were kind of searching to fit in. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, searching for identity was very important. On the one hand, I'd hear of my father's stories of India and living under colonial Britain and being affected by that. My dad studied at a Catholic school, spoke English very well before he came to the UK. In a sense, he felt very British. But on the other hand, He was keen on holding on to traditions like language, poetry, customs, culture, which were to do with the Indian subcontinent. So identity was a continuous search.
Begg's search for his identity led him down some rocky paths. He and his brother clashed with local neo-Nazi skinheads. They joined a local gang whose mission was to fight skinheads. But mostly they got beat up a lot and had run-ins with the police. At this point, Begg wasn't a practicing Muslim, but he started to notice how religion and social issues were intertwined.
I was just recently listening to some of the old tracks of UB40 from a particular album called Signing Off, and I was around 11, 12, all the way up to my teenage years, and remembering the type of social justice songs that they would sing about poverty, about unemployment, themselves being called UB40, Unemployment Benefit 40. All of this was part of building an identity of, so that the them and us wasn't always necessarily going to be in my mind about me being an Asian or British or Muslim and everybody else being something else, but it was also about class and social justice, something that my father used to talk to me about extensively as I was growing up. So part of the direction that I took about practicing my faith, being connected to it, was seen through the prism of that social justice, about looking towards people within my traditions, my background, history, or Islamic history, who manifested aspects or parts of that social justice that I was clearly seeing that there was a problem within the UK.
And I understand that the Muslims who were in Bosnia, that they were being slaughtered, that was something that really, I don't know if I can think of a better way, but kind of something kicked in for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading about the fact that there were Muslims, indigenous Muslims, who lived in Bosnia in the heart of Europe. So that was fascinating to me. I had no knowledge of what that meant about my connection to them, just only the word Muslim. That was it. It made me feel that I'm part of something far, far bigger than just the British Asian community. And I think that was part of the search, to look for belonging where I wouldn't traditionally have found it. So Bosnia was clearly something that that helped to shape my views of that.
Muslims around the world were outraged over the massacre of their brethren in Bosnia. Begg first started making donations. Eventually, he made several trips across Europe, bringing van loads of food and medicine to Bosnian forces. By the age of 30, in the late 90s, Begg had fully embraced Islam and continued to explore its emphasis on social activism. Building a school for girls in Kabul, Afghanistan, was a fulfillment of zakat, a charitable act and one of the five pillars of Islam.
The work that I was doing out there was to help to build this school essentially from scratch. And again, remember, this is at a time when the Taliban's in power, and the Taliban banned the education for females. So that was what I was involved in until, of course, the US-led invasion began and the bombing of Afghanistan.
America strikes back. Afghanistan is pounded with
the first wave, 50 Tomahawk cruise missiles, 25 warplanes off the aircraft B-52s, B-1s, and these two B-2 stealth
explosions and the rattle of anti-aircraft fire. That's been heard throughout the...
What led you to abandon the work in Afghanistan?
The U.S. bombardment, single-handedly. Cruise missiles, carpet bombs, vacuum bombs, whatever you want to call them. The bombing campaign. And one thing's important. Before we saw the bombs drop, we saw leaflets drop. And these leaflets literally offered $5,000 bounty money for every person suspected to be Taliban or Al-Qaeda was handed over for.
But as those leaflets came down, I mean, were you aware at the time that you were possibly in danger?
It's hard to describe to anyone that at a point where you think that you're safe and then literally overnight everything changes, what had happened clearly is that many members of the Taliban's security police force or whatever it was decided to turn themselves over or were captured or sold over whatever they had. But in the midst of this, of course, there's ordinary people who don't know what's going on. And essentially, a large number of people, I think myself included to some degree, were handed over as a result of this hunt for foreigners. It was literally people were being hunted. You had to find ways to get out that wouldn't cross checkpoints that the Northern Alliance had taken over. So you had to pass through all of that. So it was an odyssey for me.
And you left Afghanistan. Did you go to Pakistan?
Yeah, we were living in Islamabad, in the capital. And in the midst of all of this, a friend of mine called me and he said that MI5 were asking about you. And so I told him that I am here. I gave him my address. I told him exactly where I am, my telephone number. I said, if they want to see me, they're most welcome to come. But tell them that this is a very volatile time. I wasn't afraid of meeting with them. My concern was people are being bombed and killed where I am. So anyway, literally within a week of me telling him that, they did come, but not in the way I expected. It was on the night of the 31st January 2002. There was a knock on my door. I opened the door at midnight precisely. And a group of people stormed in, put a gun to my head, tasers crackling in the background, put me into the prone position, tied my hands behind my back with cuffs, cuffed my legs, and then put a hood over my head. That's the last vision I have of where my family were. That's the last thing my wife saw of me in that state. And they took me into the back of a vehicle and then drove me off to secret locations. And in the midst of all of that, two Americans who were driving the vehicle, one of them takes off the hood over my head, and he's dressed as a Pakistani, he's speaking in an American accent, he's white Caucasian. And he says that you can either answer our questions here or you can answer them in Guantanamo.
Despite that threat, Moazzam Begg wasn't taken to Guantanamo right away. First, he spent 6 weeks in an American makeshift prison in Kandahar. Here, he and others were processed, as he says, like animals. Punched, kicked, stripped, shaven, and photographed. But Kandahar was just the beginning. Now, as a heads up to listeners, we want you to know that from here on out, there's going to be some rough language and descriptions of physical violence.
You know, in Bagram, it was probably the worst of the whole process. I saw two people being beaten to death by American soldiers. One of them, his name was Dilawar. His prison number was 421. I remember he was shackled with his hands tied above his head to the top of the cage. He was hooded and left in this state in a, you know, 2-foot by 2-foot area. And he was kept there until his body slumped. His head didn't move anymore. And the soldiers came, they opened the door. I thought they might give him some medical attention, but they started to punch him in his ribs repeatedly and kick him and kept on doing that until he was dead. There's only one reason I know he's dead, is because when I was in Guantanamo 2 years later, American agents showed me photographs of his body. And then they bought photographs of the soldiers who were on duty that night and asked me to identify them. And bizarrely, they asked me if I'd be willing to be a witness for the prosecution against these soldiers, which was bizarre because I had been held now for almost 3 years without charge or trial and was not going to get to see any court at all.
After 10 months at Bagram Air Base, Begg was taken to the Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. It was early 2003. Begg was placed in solitary confinement at Camp Echo, where he would spend almost 2 years. Meanwhile, Corporal Albert Molisi had been called up and was sent off for 3 months of military police training at Camp Hunter Liggett in California in preparation for Guantanamo Bay. When you knew you were going to go to Guantanamo Bay, did you do anything to prepare?
Yeah, I actually bought a Quran, and I read through the Quran here and there, the English version, to educate myself so I don't disrespect anyone. Like, you hear news before I went, oh, people were stepping on Qurans, that's not what to do, it's disrespectful. Of course, it doesn't matter what religious book you have in front of you, you don't destroy someone's only hope of getting out of a place like that. But I wanted to prepare myself due to the fact that when you go to another country, you kind of want to go and respect the people.
Just before going to Gitmo, Malisi and his fellow guards went through a month-long training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, where they learned how to deal with the detainees they were going to encounter.
We'll go to these theater-type rooms and watch videos, and while they were showing flashes of Bin Laden's face while the planes are going into Twin Towers, playing like Metallica music, and you're sitting in this room and it's repetitive and they're getting you worked up and hyped up. It's a breaking down system and trying to make you focus on hate, mistrust, and anger. And that's what they were doing to the soldiers.
Did it work on you?
I would say at first, yeah. And then I realized what the hell just happened, because you feel like you're in a room where you're being brainwashed.
So are you saying that the United States military put you through a training process that would amp up your hatred towards Bin Laden and the various people who had perpetrated the attacks on September 11th?
Yes, there's no doubt. And if anyone ever tells you different, they will be lying. It's true. It happened. I was there and I was disgusted. You ask us to go overseas to do something, and here we are doing something, and it's the most aggressive thing you can ever go through. Yes, you are a soldier. You were trained to be a soldier, but you didn't train to do this type of work or think you were going to get brainwashed by your own government, but it happens.
When the Bush administration made the decision to open the detention center at Guantanamo, then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld described the people who'd be held there as the worst of the worst.
The kind of people held at Guantanamo include terrorist trainers, bomb makers, extremist recruiters and financiers, bodyguards of Osama bin Laden, and would-be suicide bombers. They are not common car thieves. They are believed to be determined killers.
After you got there, you realized they weren't the worst of the worst. That was just a scare tactic to make sure we're not going to befriend or be more common to the English-speaking detainees. They just wanted us to go in with this fear that these are the worst of the worst. And I'll tell you, after my experience, you come across of everyday people, some non-educated, some were farmers, some were actual businessmen who had like little shops, and they were nobodies. People just from whatever village was around that they were going rounding up people.
As you were going through the training, you were told that they were the worst of the worst. Were you buying that, or were you taking it with a grain of salt?
I was just taking it in, and I'm just reading between the lines. Again, I'm a citizen soldier. So what most citizen soldiers are reservists or National Guardsmen, and we have real jobs on the outside. So we think outside the box compared to an average soldier from high school who just goes into the basic training, told what to do, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, that kind of thing, cannot think for himself outside the box. You're told what to do and you do it. And that's it.
Corporal Malisi arrived in September 2003. For the first 3 months, he was assigned to Camp Delta, the main camp at Gitmo. That's where guards employed what then Vice President Dick Cheney referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques.
When I first landed there, we were so hyped up, and all the videos that we watched, and you're gung-ho, and this guy's a piece of shit, who cares what he thinks or whatever, and you're totally different when you first get there. You're totally different, and you take part in somewhat abusive behavior towards the detainee. Just because he just said something stupid or won't get out of his cell, but yet we're getting aggressive and agitated, and as soon as that cage opens up, you open a world of hurt on him. When I went to Guantanamo Bay, I didn't expect to be taking part in what I took part in. You gotta remember, I was a police officer. When I was doing that, I was also doing Big Brother type things and be a mentor for kids. So I was part of that program, and going from that and being deployed to Gitmo was a total opposite of what I was doing in life. You know, I went from helping needy kids to torturing humans, regular adults. I would chain people down to the floor, put the AC down as cold as it can get, shut the lights off, put the strobe light on, and play an Eminem song continuously. In another room, I would play like Scooby-Doo or something continuously. And this would last for hours, like to be in there from 2 hours to 10 hours over and over again.
What do you feel that the impact was on these detainees?
I think it was ways to make them confess to things that they weren't really guilty of doing. And if you torture anyone, even myself, for a while, I'm going to say whatever you want me to say. Give me the piece of paper, I'll sign whatever. And that's exactly what happened to a few of them.
Did you feel that you were representing America for better or worse to the detainees there?
I always was a good soldier, did everything I was told to do, and I liked my jobs until I went to Gitmo. And when I was there, I wasn't representing the real America. I was representing what they want America to look like to detainees. If you understand that answer.
Yeah.
And we're not. So propaganda works both ways. Propaganda works against you and for you. And when you use your soldiers in propaganda to trick detainees, that's fine. But when it backfires and it's also tricking the soldier, and you're trying to do that, that was your mission in the first place, to trick both so they won't know what's really going on. So soldiers won't talk freely to detainees, and detainees won't talk freely to the soldiers. But it backfired on the military, because soldiers are human, just like detainees, and they associated with each other.
Former Guantanamo MP Albert Malisi. After a short break, Albert and Moazzam Beg finally meet.
He said, I should just change my religion, become Christian. I said, what are you, some kind of jackass? Right to his face.
In solitary confinement, people see you at your best and your worst, and Albert saw me at both.
I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
You're listening to Us and Them. I'm Trey Kay. In early 2004, Guantanamo officials transferred specialist Albert Malisi to Camp Echo, where Moazzam Beg was detained.
You'd know some MPs just didn't want to talk at all, and some of them didn't have the capacity to have discussions outside of their experience of life and didn't want to.
Once he knew I was slightly intelligent, he became friends. We played chess.
I think I taught him how to play chess as I remember. He didn't know how to play. It wasn't in my cell, it was outside, so I'd have to tell them which pieces to move.
I don't think I've ever beaten him in chess. There was a place where there was no moves left for either one of us. We drew out twice that happened. The rest of the time, he beat me like 23 times.
First time I ever saw the film Snatch with Brad Pitt and I don't know who else, was in Guantanamo, because Albert
snuck in. DVD player and DVDs. I would show him movies like Braveheart and stuff like that, some role model type.
It wasn't just Albert, it was many other soldiers. They understood that a little bit of humanity wouldn't really harm anybody, and I didn't want any of the soldiers to get in trouble on my part.
I'd probably get shipped home and dishonorably discharged or something because I was National Guard. Who knows? I really don't know. I know I would have been punished.
Talked about some of his struggles in his life and difficulties he had. And we talk.
He's going to go home, and whatever political group he's in or other parties or whatever there is out there, he's going to say, holy shit, not all Americans are bad like we are led to believe by this party or anyone else.
Many other prisoners left Guantanamo, not filled with hatred of the United States of America because of soldiers like Albert.
Baig had been at Gitmo for over a year when Malisi was assigned to his cell block. At that point, he'd been in solitary confinement for 12 months, and he was starting to unravel.
It's debilitating, corrosive, destructive. It's, I think, the first and only times in my life I've had, you know, real panic attacks have been in and the only first time in my life I ever saw a psychiatrist was in Guantanamo in solitary confinement. And this is when I understood that even the psychiatrists who come in their military combat clothing regard you as the enemy. One of the a psychiatrist came once when I was, after I had a panic attack. I'd been, you know, I was punched and kicked and screamed and just literally was losing my mind. I was in a cell that there was no natural light. You didn't know whether it was day or night outside. You didn't know the month or the time or the year or anything. And so she came along and she sat across my cell and she asked me if I'd ever considered taking my trousers off, threading them with my sheet and tying them like in a noose around my neck and tying it to the top of the cell and jumping off. I said, no, not until you put the thought in my mind. You know, it's funny to think about it now, but three people died in Guantanamo after I left by about 3 months by hanging themselves, three prisoners. So there were really sinister things happening. And I think that, you know, whatever Hippocratic oath these doctors may have signed simply didn't apply in Guantanamo.
He went on sessions. When he came back, I asked him, I said, hey, man, you all right? Everything cool? And he's like, I don't want to be bothered. And he started tearing in his cell, and I can hear him. He's trying to hide it from me. And I said, all right, that's it. What's up? What's the matter with you? And he told me, they told him he should kill himself. He'll have a better chance of getting out of there by God than walking out. I remember it like clear as day.
Well, one of the things that I heard you talk about is you told a story about how Moezem had, I guess, spoke to some of the other prison guards. And he said something like, what do you think? Should I give up my faith and make it easier on myself?
Yes. That was the first question he asked me when I went into the camp, his camp. He said, I should just, you know, change my religion, become Christian. I said, what are you, some kind of jackass? Why would you do that? No matter what you're going through, hardships in your life right now, you don't go changing your only source of higher power. You stick to it, and you always stick to it.
There was a period of time when my faith was at its all-time low. I don't think in the way that he perhaps might have interpreted it, that giving up my faith meant giving up being a Muslim. I think I would always be a Muslim, even if I gave up its practice. But to me, perhaps that's what I meant, is that if I give up the practice of my faith, then maybe things will become easier. I know that in solitary confinement, people see you at your best and your worst. And Albert saw me at both. And that, you know, certainly happened in when I was in Guantanamo and Camp Echo in particular, that there was a point at which my faith in terms of practical application hardly existed at certain points. It came back when I realized that it had been this that had sustained me through all of the difficult parts in the beginning, and that my own kind of personal weakness was also part of that test that I felt I had to pass through. And I think people like Albert helped me to question myself as well about that.
Baig says in his early days at Guantanamo, he tried to be compliant with his American captors. He hoped this might lead to an opportunity to tell his story in court and expose his unjust treatment. But that opportunity never materialized. After a while, Baig became resigned to perhaps never getting out and seeing his family again. But instead of this resignation causing him to feel more depressed, he says that he adopted a "I'm beginning to like it here" attitude, and that this change in perspective helped him survive his detention. Then on June 28, 2004, the United States Supreme Court ruled that Guantanamo Bay detainees could petition federal courts for writs of habeas corpus to review the legality of their detention. Unknown to Baig, his father had been working and campaigning for his release all this time, and now pounced on this new legal window. Britain, too, had been asking the U.S. to transfer Begg and three other British detainees back to England. Finally, in early 2005, over the objections of the FBI, CIA, and Pentagon, President Bush authorized Begg's return to the U.K. You were released from Guantanamo in 2005. What was that like?
It was surreal. I remember the day it happened. A naval officer came to confirm that I was being released. They said no charges. I think they wanted me to sign some kind of agreement or confession or something before I left. I said, I'm not doing that now. I can't even remember what it was about. It was something about agreeing not to prosecute or seek prosecution against the United States or something like that. I flatly refused to do that. And then for the first time in all these years, I walked unshackled onto this plane, sat on there. They brought in food and chocolates and things I hadn't seen for all this time. And then newspapers, and I saw myself with the other prisoners on the front pages of these newspapers. We arrived back into the UK and eventually was driven to the police station where I was arrested under some terrorism act. I heard sounds of people protesting outside. I learned that my father was outside too. The police officer asked me if I wanted to make any phone calls, and it first dawned on me that I can actually call people. But I refused to do so. I refused to see my father, anybody in the police station, because I...
Why?
Because I wanted to see him as a free man, not as a prisoner. So they held me, I think, overnight, and the next day I was taken to my lawyer's house, and there for the first time I met my father, my brothers, my wife, my children, and my youngest son, who I'd never seen the first time he was born.
What was that like?
It's hard to describe. Everybody was emotional. Everybody was, except me. I think my mechanism, my coping mechanism, had been to solidify myself through my own solitary confinement. So, cutting myself off from all familial kind of ties, really, and just telling myself that I have to get through what I have in front of me and don't concern myself or think too much about what's happening elsewhere. And part of that was, as I said, resignation to my fate. When I started doing that, it became easier. But everybody else was in tears, but happy also. I mean, great joy. My father had become this massive campaigner. He had two or three mobile phones ringing at the same time, fending off calls from every news outlet you can think of, and on television, campaigning. I mean, he became pretty much a household name at that time. And then within a couple of days, I came back home and I sat in my front room, realized the gas fire wasn't working. So I asked my daughter if I still had tools here, and she bought my tools. And so the first thing I did was to fix my gas fire.
Wow. So how long do you think it took things to normalize?
I don't think things have ever normalized. I think part of that is because of what I've chosen to do since my return. The majority of former Guantanamo prisoners haven't chosen to, speaking a word of truth against oppression. They haven't chosen to do that. Most of them have chosen to go and maybe do one or two interviews about something and then just try to live their lives normally.
Today, Albert Malisi says his first few months at Guantanamo, being part of Camp Delta's torture regimen, almost broke him.
I was a police officer. I carry a different face when I'm in that uniform. The same thing in that military uniform. I carry a different face. I'm strong, strong-willed, but it bothers me, certain things. And I started to drink heavily to cope with what was happening on that island. Like bottles of 151. I would finish two a day by the end I left that island.
Two bottles of 151?
Yeah, that's Bacardi 151.
Yeah. Wow.
It was tough. And then, like, people would write me up and stuff because I was holding back, arguing with my own soldiers. This is wrong. What we're doing here is wrong.
Malisi's superiors decided he might do better at Camp Echo, a different Guantanamo camp where he met Moazzam Begg. This camp was supposed to be lighter on the enhanced interrogation techniques.
It wasn't supposed to be like Camp Delta, but it was like Camp Delta in Camp Echo, where Mozan was. They go through more interview sessions. They don't come out and just say it's a torture. They go into an interview, or they go into the dental or medical, take them to the psych tier where they keep all the prisoners that lost their minds there. But if you're in there and you see what I saw, you know it's torture. And I think it's just because I try to block out most of Delta. When I came home, I continued drinking for 8 years until I went to AA meetings at the VA. And I thought I was an alcoholic, and I really wasn't. I was coping with all those things I try to block out of my mind. And it came out in some of the sessions. So they sent me to another building for post-traumatic stress disorder, and then they diagnosed me with that. 50%, they gave me disability a couple of years ago. And it was all due to Guantanamo Bay, so. It has affected me in certain ways in my life still to this day. And how long has it been? It's 14, and it still has an effect.
Can you give me some examples of the effect that it has? I mean,
well, when just talking to you, I tear a lot right now, and it's hard. It's hard to get myself to talk about some of that stuff today. And I do it in sessions on Saturdays, but it's not always about that. It's just everyday things about what's happening in your life and what's going on. It's just like I can't go to a court system down here where you do a traffic thing because it's in a prison and it has the mesh gates on it. So I hear the noise, and it just, I have to take a deep breath and close my eyes and pretend I'm not at Guantanamo just to go pay a ticket or something. I have anxiety, huge anxieties. I used to live in a house right next to my bedroom window. There was a gate, and 3 o'clock in the morning when the neighbors come home from work or whatever, they open and shut that gate. I wake up, I think I'm back at Gemmo. It would bother me. I jump up in fear, grab my gun, and search my house. That's how bad I was.
And do you compare these experiences with other soldiers who served at Guantanamo?
Well, in my group, there are no other soldiers that went to Gemmo. In my group, they're like, what I say, real soldiers, full-time soldiers, who experience different post-traumatic stress disorder. It's combat related, or stuff in Iraq where their buddy just blew up, or they got shrapnel because their Humvee just blew up, or it's that kind of stuff. So theirs is different than mine, and I always feel guilty that I'm in that room, and I feel guilty sometimes that I'm getting paid disability for them, and more than they are, and they got hurt. You know, they physically got hurt. They weren't like mentally hurt. You understand what I'm trying to say?
I do.
So my PTSD is something different. Some moral are hurt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm following.
So, it's tough.
Yeah.
So, I feel guilty when I go into those groups sometimes, and I shouldn't. And my therapist tells me, you know, you shouldn't. This is for everyone. These groups are for everyone who has, you have a different type of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just like if you had it from childhood or something. You know, you were abused or something, and that's traumatic for you. It's a different type. So you have to sit in the groups and really focus that your stories are good stories, and it's your version of what happened to you. You weren't shot at, whatever. You weren't blown up or any of that stuff. It's just a different moral post-traumatic stress disorder hurtness. And it took 4 years for me to even believe that.
After Albert and Moazzam both were out of Guantanamo, they found each other on Facebook and spoke a few times via phone. Baig had joined a human rights advocacy organization called Cage Prisoners. This group works to empower communities that have been impacted by the so-called war on terror. He'd also detailed his experience in a book and a documentary film.
we had this film screening. It was called The Confession. It's based on my experience of Guantanamo and everything that was around it. Albert was coming anyway to the UK to visit relatives. And I asked Albert if he'd like to come to one of the screenings in my home city of Birmingham.
Yeah, it took a lot of stones because I wasn't sure if I should or whatever. Contact him while I was there. And actually, he was on like my Facebook or Instagram, and he asked me if I would do this interview for promotional of his movie, his premiere. It was scary at first because I didn't know if I was going to be detained for going to visit him or not.
You were afraid you'd be detained? I don't understand that.
Detained, yeah, because I'm sure I was flagged after my interviews. And here I am taking a trip to England. I was nervous. I was expecting Interpol or MI5 to come get me while I was having dinner with this guy or at the movie theater doing the interview. I was scared. That's where I was scared. Not of my life, of where my surroundings were. I was afraid I might not come home. Be detained myself.
Malisi wasn't just being paranoid. He had reason to worry. When he reconnected with Beg around 2009, their Skype calls prompted a visit from a U.S. military intelligence officer. According to Malisi, the officer said that he was concerned about a 2011 media interview in which Malisi talked about another detainee, David Hicks. He was afraid Malisi might expose some Guantanamo secrets. So, yeah, he was worried that visiting England might flag him for similar government scrutiny. But Malisi decided to go anyway.
And he said he'd love to, and we'd have dinner here, and he'd come and stay with me. I said, I can put you at a hotel. He said, no, I want to stay with you. And I said, of course, you know, that's what I envisaged. So myself, my son, we picked him up at the train station when he came. It was just like meeting a long-lost brother. I mean, it was really like that.
At first, I was nervous and afraid, and then it just all eased. Everything, once I seen him, and everything was at ease.
So that night, Albert came and he stayed with me. And I told Albert, you know, this is your house. Welcome anytime. Just got to give you a little warning. This time, I have the keys. And... You know, that was our little laugh together.
Moazzam Beg and Albert Malisi have been away from Guantanamo for several years, but clearly the experience lives on in their psyches. And the story of Guantanamo goes on. The detention center was opened as a result of the attacks of September 11th. According to Human Rights First, of the 780 detainees who had been brought to that facility, 500 were let go during the Bush administration. The Obama administration transferred, repatriated, or resettled another 197. The detention center remains open with 40 detainees. And Guantanamo Bay has the support of President Donald Trump. He announced an executive order nearly a year ago to keep the detention center open. President Trump says anyone detained at Guantanamo satisfies the definition of a terrorist. He says that if the U.S. releases them from Guantanamo, they could rejoin the fight. Have you rejoined the fight?
I think I never left the fight, did I? Obama had said, didn't he, when he came into power, he said he will close Guantanamo. He said that before he came to power. And when he came to power, within, a couple of days, he signed an executive order to close Guantanamo within a year. That was in 2009. I remember that year. I remembered it because the first of the American soldiers who'd come to visit me was touring with me in the UK. We did a tour called The Two Sides, One Story. So I remember very well both of us saying that it's too little, too late, and we don't even believe him. And it came to pass that... 8-odd years later, or 7 years later, he didn't close Guantanamo. He couldn't. So even when you say you're going to close Guantanamo, you can't or you won't. And so when Trump says that he's going to keep the place open, I believe him completely because he's doing what he says he believes in. That's the only difference.
Do you think it's unfair to ask soldiers like yourself to accept what they see and experience at Guantanamo and not ask questions and just trust in the system and just
understand that the alleged guilt of the detainees is true.
Okay. They make you sign a paper when you first get there. And it takes your right to speak to any media or anybody else after your time on Guantanamo Bay. And if you go against that, you can be punished. So they take away your First Amendment rights. But once you're out of their command, I strongly believe that the moral part of the story is to tell the story, to tell what's going on in this place, to tell what you see in the big picture. Oh, it's not just Germany torturing people. It's not Vietnam torturing people. Guess what? America tortures people too. It's not all that apple pie crap you see all on the movies. And that's why I signed Mickey Mouse on my thing. They remade me sign it when I left.
Did you sign it?
No, I still didn't sign it. I still left. What are you going to do? Keep me? They'll run out of money. They can't just keep a soldier. They're going to have to send him home.
So I just want to be clear. You have never signed some type of non-disclosure agreement saying that you're not going to talk about what you
I never put my real name on it. I signed it. I just didn't put my name. I put Mickey Mouse on it.
Okay.
And I still get in trouble because they said I signed it. And I know for a fact I didn't. So they couldn't really punish me. They can only bar me from reenlistment. They couldn't put me dishonorable discharge. Couldn't tell that I gave away classified information because I still don't talk about classified information. That hasn't already been out in the news. Now I can talk about certain things because it has been out in the news.
Former Guantanamo MP Albert Malisi. I asked Moazzem Begg what the U.S. government should do with those who remain at Guantanamo.
Well, look, in America, you have prosecuted people for terrorism left, right, and center and give them hundreds of years in prison. So it's not for the lack of having a system that you can't prosecute them. It's just the fact that if you have these prisoners, if they are innocent, if they haven't been charged after 15 years, 16 years, interrogated by the world's most powerful, law enforcement intelligence agencies, If you can't do that after 15 years, you're never going to do it. So it's time to think about releasing them. It's time to think about places where they can go home to build up whatever life they have. And as far as your question of the recidivism, they're going to go back to the battlefield. I think your battlefields are already filled with people who weren't even in Guantanamo. So that's no longer a problem or a priority. You've created people, as I said, that are far worse than the original that you were trying to fight.
With regard to your experience at Guantanamo, do you think that we have something that we need to own up to?
I think so, but the problem is that, with the greatest respect of owning up to all of these things, it has no bearing, because you could add many other things, Vietnam and Korea and God knows where else, Iraq 1 and Iraq 2 and Afghanistan. The problem is that if you f*** up once, maybe, and if you do it twice, maybe three times, but repeatedly, it becomes systematic. Then it's no longer, in my view, just a mistake. This is by design, and I cannot, this is not some kind of third world country under resourced that is unable to make decisions. This is the most powerful advanced democracy in the world. It is the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons. So let's absolutely be under no illusion that the violence and the erosion and the abuse of human rights meted out by the United States of America is completely in line with what it has done since its inception. I think that's the hard truth. If you want to own up to something, you have to own up to what it is that you've become. I think America has to own up to a lot more. America owned up to the CIA Senate torture report. But what's the point of owning up to something when nobody's going to be prosecuted for it? It's like me, can you imagine if we said, can the 9/11 guys who did 9/11, can they just own up, please, and we can turn the page? Nobody would accept that for them. So I think America not only has to own up, it has to hold itself to account, and I don't think it will ever be prepared for that.
Do you hate Americans?
No, because of Albert. Because of Albert and people like him, no. I don't. I made friends with a lot of soldiers then, and that has to be the one aspect of Guantanamo, I have to say, the one part of Guantanamo which I have always been happy for. Building relationships with people like Albert and others, they made all the difference. Those ordinary, decent American individuals, they made a massive difference in my existence in Guantanamo, and I'll never forget them.
As I spoke with Begg, I couldn't help thinking about how I felt after 9/11. Not only had the terrorists hit my country, they deeply wounded my city, murdered some of my neighbors, and nearly killed a family member. Like many Americans, I wanted vengeance. I was swept up in the groundswell of emotions. I wanted to go and get them. And even though I was a little too old at the time, I honestly considered enlisting in the military. As powerful as we are, and as hurt as we were, there was no question America's reaction would be huge. And I can understand how a person like Moazzam Begg was swept into our whirlwind reaction. What I strain to comprehend now is the us and them divide over the support for Guantanamo. On one side, there are Americans who cheer President Trump for keeping Guantanamo open because they believe the detention of suspected terrorists and information obtained through torture protect us from another 9/11. On the other, there are those who believe that as long as the injustice that Gitmo represents continues, we're giving folks like Al-Qaeda and ISIS reason to attack us. I understand our nation needs to be wary and vigilant of people with the intent to do our nation harm. But when we build facilities like Guantanamo, detain people without judicial process, and subject them to interrogation that cleverly tries to work around the international definition of torture, we create more victims of the original tragedy. And some of these victims are our veterans. Albert Molisi's instincts of showing humanity towards his captive were unorthodox and even punishable by the U.S. military. Yet, 14 years after leaving that island, he still struggles with what he did to other detainees. I wonder how many of us consider what the war on terror did to him, and ultimately, how it affects us all. And have we lost some of our humanity in the process?
You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team is me, Trey Kay, Loretta Williams, Mitch Hanley, Kate Smith, and Rima Snyder. Special thanks to the Departments of Communication and Digital Media and Journalism at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Additional music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.